This is an ABC podcast.
G'day, beloved listeners. Welcome to another edition of LNL on RN Summer. But first, a return to our India Now programs with a look at the social and sexual revolution sweeping the subcontinent. In the words of my guest, Ira Trivedi, young middle-class urban couples in India are increasingly choosing to marry for love and not by family arrangement. Now, with these changes comes greater personal freedom and sexual equality. But there's also a downside to the sexual revolution, a rise in teenage pregnancy and divorce rates, as well as a violent backlash against sexual excess. Now, these changes are documented in Ira's book, In Love, Marriage and Sexuality in the 21st Century. She's an author, a columnist, and a yoga teacher. When I spoke to her, I was in the full lotus position and asked if the subcontinent's sexual revolution differed from the one we saw in the West in the 1960s.
Absolutely. It's different because it's happening at cyber speed. There was no mobile phone. There was no internet. There was no Facebook or Instagram or dating apps back in the 60s. And now there are. India is as technologically savvy as the West, if not more. India's young is well connected, and that's why it's happening at a very, very high speed. The other thing is that it's happening with no real stages. In the West, it was, the concept of arranged marriage died down, and people began marrying for love. And once people began marrying for love, that's when, sexual revolution had steps. Here, we're going from a very archaic concept where a lot of people, I'm 30 years old, for most of my people in my generation, their parents had arranged marriages and they were often married before they were, before they were 18 years old. Grandparents, most people my age, their grandparents were married when they were children, 6, 7, 8 years old. And this is the norm. Young people don't have any wisdom to fall back on. They don't have wisdom of their parents, of anyone who came before them, who navigated the dating landscape.
I remember on my first trip to India asking about arranged marriage and being told very firmly that you marry who you love, we love who we marry. Was it always a catastrophic thing for Indian women?
I'm going to answer this question a little indirectly. So, and it's going back to what you heard on the streets of India. So earlier there was a formulaic process. You would get married, you would have sex with the person you got married to, and then you may or may not fall in love with that person. And if you did, great. If you did not, then you just bear with the marriage, because even till 1950 something, I'm forgetting the exact year, there was no divorce. There was no divorce in the Indian constitution. Today, in today's age, love, marriage, sex, it's an any permutation combination, just like in the West. You can have sex, you may or may not get married, you definitely may or may not fall in love. You may fall in love, you may have sex, you may get married. So there's this little formula, which was an age-old formula in India of marriage, sex, and love, doesn't exist any longer.
You spent quite a lot of time living in New York, living that roller coaster dating kind of life. How did you find your life among your contemporaries when you returned to New Delhi?
It was very interesting. Actually, that's what first prompted me to write India and Love, because of the real irony that existed here, because there were so many young people like me. And, even more so today. This was when I moved back. It was six, seven years ago. And India has changed considerably because of the internet. There was no Tinder in India when I moved back. And today, India, I think, is a very large market for Tinder. I think it's one of Facebook's largest markets. So, it was strange because on one hand, young people were eager to explore the other sex. They were going out in all like in coffee shops and cafes and restaurants and nightclubs. And there was a lot of exploration happening. But the very same people were then meeting arranged candidates or meeting candidates for arranged marriage through family, through marriage brokers, through, through online portals that acted as sort of a Tinder for marriage. And this was always, it was all happening at the very same time. It was the same people who were dating who were also looking at arranged marriage because it was a transition time. People weren't ready to give up. You know, they weren't able to stand up maybe to the family pressure or to the guilt or to the cultural norm that we have to get married at a certain age to a certain kind of a boy. I'm talking about girls or even men. Same thing. We should get married to a certain kind of a girl at a certain time, and this girl should be approved by our families.
You found the idea, well, you observed that people were being rampantly dating and mating, and that some women were planning on continuing that lifestyle after marriage.
Absolutely, because a lot of people married for, and I document this in India in Love. There's a chapter called Modern Love in which I talk about couples who are exploring open marriages because they were married when they were, 18, 19 years old, as is the norm in India. Even now the age has come up slightly, but people here have arranged marriages when they're quite young. But then the world has changed in the past 10 years. You know, everything has changed. The culture has changed. There's so many, there's entire westernized cities that have come up in the past 10 years. You know, you go there and you can easily be in Shanghai or Beijing or anywhere else, even I wouldn't say quite say New York yet, but we're getting there, And so with the change of this, and everyone is online, it's easy to find sexual partners, it's easy to find partners to date. So yes, people are exploring new paradigms of relationships because suddenly the world has opened up and this was never the case. For some people, it's just a part and parcel of family life. You marry someone who is from a certain kind of a family, who will bring up your children in a certain way, who will be the right kind of husband or wife. And that's one side of your life. And then you can have your other side, which is your personal conquest, which is perhaps a girlfriend. It's a mistress. Perhaps it's a boyfriend, an affair that you're having. And some people are able to absolutely bifurcate that in a very clean manner.
As a youngster growing up in the 1990s, you thought that sex was bad and it must never be talked about, mm-hmm. even during your college years. And as you're saying, the scene is completely different. Have women been the main instigator of change?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I do think that the sexual revolution in India is led by women. And it's because women have come forward in all arenas of life, whether it's entering the workforce, whether it's choosing to study more, whether it's choosing to really loosen the chastity belt. It's women who are leading this sexual revolution. And let me add the good part of it. It's women who are choosing to come forward to talk about sexual violence as well. It's all part and parcel of the same thing. And it's frankly leaving the men a little confused. A lot of young men who I meet, they say that we don't quite understand. Girls seem to us so confusing now because they are a little confused. For girls, it is a time of transition. They're trying to figure out, hey, are we going to be the girl who our parents want us to be? Are we going to live the life that they have, they have in mind for us, which is finding a suitable boy and settling down and maybe being a housewife? Or are we going to go out there and follow our own dreams and ambitions? And to be honest, parents today, a lot of parents who I meet, they encourage their girls to work. But they're clear about one thing, that once you get married, you can work if your parent-in-laws are happy with it. Otherwise, you won't work. That family comes first, your husband comes first, family comes first, and we don't want anything to interfere with your marriage because marriage is the number one most important thing in a girl's life in India, even till today. And unless this mentality changes, it's going to be very hard for the country to progress in any which way, economically, culturally, etc.
We know that India has a history of intense sexuality, what you describe as both the profane and the holy. those extraordinary temple figures, and they seem to coexist harmoniously in ancient times. Sex wasn't taboo, but those cavorting Hindu sculptures pointing to the joy of the gods, or were they literally advocating sex for the mortals?
It's unclear what the depictions were meant for, and I do think that a lot of it has been erased by history. You know, a lot of it's been erased on purpose by history, because after, you know, those times, there was Mughal invasions, and with Islam came a much more conservative time than the British. And then there were the Indians themselves, with even Mahatma Gandhi. He really did advocate a very, you know, celibacy amongst many of his followers. So
not that he invariably practiced it, but let's not dwell on the Mahatma.
So
here there is a history of intense sexuality. We know all about the sexual explanations of the Kama Sutra, written in what, 300 CE. But not everyone supported the attitudes of the Kama Sutra's author. In fact, this coexisted with a staunch patriarchal attitude which was against women's sexual pleasure. So does India, well, it must still remain a country with these opposing views.
Even in the ancient times, you know, in the times of the Kama Sutra, these were pockets of sensuality and sexuality, because India, in those times, it was like Europe. It was made up of many different kingdoms. There was not one cohesive India. There was not one cohesive Bharat. There was many, many different little kingdoms, and each kingdom had a very unique culture. So while there were parts which were very open, you know, there were other parts that were conservative as well. So there wasn't an entire culture in all of India. There were selective pockets, but that in those pockets, sex, sexuality, sensuality were all explored, and they were considered sacred, in fact.
During Mughal rule, sex wasn't frowned upon. I understand that all changed with the British.
Even during Mughal times, actually, there was, you know, again, each ruler had his own culture that he really brought forth. It was absorbed in some kingdoms, it wasn't absorbed by other, because at that point, even then, kingdoms were ruled separately by Indian rulers, and they all came under the Mughal umbrella. But yes, the British did bring a certain sense of prudery, because do remember, this was Victorian times, and the British did bring Victorian views to India. And then it was the Indians themselves. There was an entire movement by an entire group of leaders in which, you know, celibacy and you know, men and women were separated. So even though in Britain, you know, the Victorian times were coming to an end, in India, they never really ended. In fact, they just kind of got worse and worse and worse. And things got more and more and more prude. In fact, till it was a universal culture in India. But finally, now we are beginning to come out of these Victorian boundaries, I would say. And it's happening at astonishing speed.
What are the downsides of this?
You know, like with any revolution, there's obviously positives, but there is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of friction, a lot of chaos, there's a lot of violence. That's, you know, that comes part and parcel of any revolution. And in India as well, the backlash has been a violent backlash, and the violent backlash comes in terms of, you know, the traditional forces trying to maintain their standards. There's a certain strata of society that doesn't want anything to change. So when they see young couples falling in love, they try to stop that. That's why honor killings happen when families kill their own children, because the children, to maintain family honor, because children have decided, you know, have they want to marry of their own volition. So they actually kill them, saying that, you know, we won't take this at all. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of, even amongst families, a lot of friction, because young people may decide to marry on their own. They've decided to move out of their parents' homes. So there is a lot of change and turbulence on a cultural level amongst families, and also in things like honor killings. And at the same time, even sexual violence. While it is true what I said earlier, that women are more confident of coming out and speaking about it, because because having these conversations, even listening to something like this, has given women the encouragement and faith required to speak up and speak out. But at the same time, it's also increasing. Sexual violence is increasing because as urbanization happens at cyber speed, there's a lot of migration which is happening. You know, people are coming. It's one of the largest migrations in all of history, India's rural to urban migration. The numbers are actually astonishing. I haven't looked back recently, but it's something like every minute, about 70 to 80 people are migrating every 1 minute from the village into the city. So because of, you know, migration, there's such a huge change in culture from village life to city life. What they're seeing, they may never have seen the face of another woman except for their mothers and sisters, because in some villages it's so conservative, and they suddenly come into the city and they're seeing, they have access to pornography on their phones. They see billboards with very sexual images on them. They go into malls and see girls in skirts. It's sometimes too much to handle for young men who are separated from their families, from their wives, from any sort of sexual pleasure at all. So it is very much a culture in flux. And yes, we do have a problem. There is, you know, women, are they safe on India's streets, or in at least in some cities? They are safe, but they do have to take precautions. Indian police forces have become much more vigilant and cognizant about what's happening. But yes, I still tell all women that do not take a taxi in the dark by yourself after sunlight. Make sure you have friends with you. When you're going out, have an emergency number, have pepper spray with you. These are all precautions that we do have to take, because yes, the streets of Delhi are not as safe as they should be.
Tell me about Love Commandos.
Oh, the Love Commandos. It was probably one of my favorite parts of writing the book. So the Love Commandos is an organization based in Delhi, which actually helps couples in love. So right now I told you a little bit about what honor killings were. And when these young couples need to escape the wrath of their families, who will kill them just to preserve the honor of the family, then the Love Commandos actually set up shop to help these couples in love. So they come to the village or wherever these young people are. They give them shelter. They protect them from parents so they don't find out. They help them get police support. They help them get married. They sponsor their weddings so that no one can legally take them apart. They help. They counsel them. They advise them. They advise girls to wait till they're of adult age so that they can exercise their own choices and they can legally marry. And so it's a wonderful organization, and the work that they're doing is superb.
Look, thank you very much for that Ira Trivedi, author, columnist. Her works include India in Love, Marriage and Sexuality in the 21st Century. Very good to talk to you.
Thank you. That was fabulous.
Back in 2014, India's PM, Narendra Modi, made a core promise to clean up the country's public spaces and put a toilet in every household. It was an ambitious goal. India's cities, rivers and streets are choked with litter of every kind, and open defecation remains a widespread practice. But Modi's bid to sweep away the dirt also faces several complicating social and cultural factors. Authors Asa Duron and Robin Jeffrey argue in their new book, Waste of a Nation, Garbage and Growth in India, that the stigmas attached to those who deal with waste are an obstacle in the country's sustainable future. Asa and Robin join me to offer an historical and anthropological account of India's relationship with garbage. Asa, in your opening chapter, you quote a bloke who says, why is India so filthy? Well, can you give us a quick sketch of the scale of the problem? How filthy is it?
Well, you know, India... as they, Arthur Koestler, when he came to India in the 1960s, said when he left to the airport in Mumbai, he said, "I feel like I'm covered with a wet nappy." It is a place that has really stimulated a lot of reactions from people who visited. Some people, when I met in India, said they can't believe the amount of filth that they see on the street, the smells, the odors, the people who are beggars, the waste collectors. And the scale is enormous when India accelerated since the 1990s and came into the world, if you will, and began following suit of the Western world and engaging in, you know, consumer behavior.
And so you actually asked Modi why he'd chosen Clean India as the centerpiece of his campaign. What did he say to you?
I think Modi's main concern was he himself experienced this problem of waste, this crisis of waste, and when he was in 1979 in the Morbi collapse, the dam collapse, where thousands of people perished and disease flourished in the area, and he wanted to stop that and clean the area and manage the waste and sanitation and floods that came alongside them. Two decades later, he spoke about the plague that hit Surat in Gujarat. Actually, I was in India at the time, and I recall my wife and I, the airports were closed. People were using incense in order to try and clear the air of what was thought to be a bubonic plague or some kind of plague. In the end, we know that it wasn't that. But India was very much isolated from the world. And Modi was then very high in the RSS, which is a Hindu organization. And he came to Surat and tried again to mitigate the problem that people realized. Surat was one of the dirtiest places in India 3 years later.
I know he made the point that open defecation is a particular problem for women who are, well, forced to endure indignity at best, harassment, rape, etc., because they have to go out in the dark, unprotected, to relieve themselves.
Indeed. And what we found, which was kind of counterintuitive, is that even when you place those toilets in the homes of women in rural areas and other places, they wouldn't use them because many of these women will then have to lug the water another 2-4 kilometers a day in order to clean the toilets. And many of the women find respite in actually leaving the household and the in-laws' place and going to gossip with other women. When they go and defecate or urinate, they have that space. They even use their mobile phones when they're away from this, you know, supervising eye of the family. So it's not... Plonking toilets is not the solution. It needs to be far more effective and culturally sensitive and understanding of how and why people should use toilets, like exactly like they educated people why they should take up their mobile phones. There's over almost 2 billion mobile phones now in India.
And that reminds me of the fact, Robin, that when you were last on the program, it was mobile phones we were discussing, the transformational impact.
Well, I think that's the hopeful sign in the whole notion that you can create a cleaner India, that there's been a terrific change in communication in the last 15 years, an amazing kind of transformation in the way in which people are able to link with others for political purposes. Now, often this can be for bad reasons, but it also means that people previously, without any kind of recourse to higher authority, now can communicate through various means. We were talking earlier, Philip, about the fact that you might even, in a sense, skip the literacy stage.
This is a conversation we were having off air, because when the program was last in India 20 years ago, and I was looking at the spaghetti of cables, I wrote about it. I said, look, India, if it gets the mobile phone technology, could not only unscramble the skies, but they could leapfrog over traditional literacy notions.
Very much. And if you get the kinds of transformations that the mobile phone has brought in the way people communicate and experience entertainment, anything is possible. And of course, this kind of technology is part of the campaign the government is waging for the Cleaner India.
Okay, Robin, you point out that one of the obstacles the Clean India campaign faces is the clash between religion and science. How does that clash manifest?
Well, I think it manifests itself in the form of caste. that there is a shared belief, if you are a particularly Orthodox person born into a Hindu tradition, that some people carry pollution with them, that they are somehow tainted.
And isn't it an irony that if you visit the Ganges at Varanasi, here are people bathing in this open sewer, cleaning their teeth in it, and yet they won't accept food that's been prepared by a Dalit.
Well, or even food that's prepared by someone that might be a little bit suspect. But as you say, the Ganga carries no pollution. The Ganga is a purificatory river.
Okay, so this is the big issue in your view, the caste issue.
Caste is one of the two unique elements, in my view, that make India's problems with the waste that we all experience as urbanizing middle-class societies and growing societies, with our populations growing in the case of India. But volume is huge. India has a density of population that's really unequaled by any other country in the world for the size of the country. And, of course, caste is the other element in this.
Well, one of the other problems is that in the West we associate environmental problems with the consumerist throwaway culture. But UNESCO note that India joined that culture relatively late.
Yes, and it joined after many, many years of frugality. Now, perhaps all rural societies were frugal, but India was particularly frugal. Again, this is one of the very positive sides of Hinduism, the notion that austerity is a virtuous thing, and that at the end of your life, if you're living a good life, the final stage is to become very austere and get rid of all foolish fripperies of material life.
I well remember the way Indians would use leaves to wrap food, or they'd brush their teeth with neem twigs, and in fact often serve food in the most beautiful little terracotta bowls, which were then thrown away. But of course terracotta is hardly a pollutant. It was almost a charming culture.
Yeah, there was an interesting experiment about 15, 20 years ago when the railways minister said we'll serve all the drinks on the Indian railways with clay bowls. But it didn't last very long, and it took a lot of labour to make all those little clay cups for Indian railways.
Who collects garbage in India at the moment, Robin, before we go back to Asra? I understand the rag and bone men are still available.
Well, the Kabariwala is the Indian equivalent. And of course, the Kabariwala is a great figure. Anyone over 30 has a wonderful Kabariwala story about how the Kabari would come and your mother would be waiting for him to pounce on him with newspapers accumulated over the previous 2 or 3 weeks, and then would haggle with him about how much he was going to pay for those newspapers. The Kabariwala tradition is still there. This is one of the other pluses that India has in dealing with or attempting a cleaning up of India, that it has this tradition of recycling. India was recycling long before the term was coined, and that's a great advantage to be built on, and is being built on in some parts of India.
So tell me about manual scavenging, as it's euphemistically called.
Well, these are people who actually go across, they're very poor, whether they're Dalits or poor Muslims or people who are coming into the city and they don't have any other line of work. And this is a very easy way to get some meager income. And they go around the street and take whatever rubbish is thrown away. And I mean, you wouldn't, I think it's, I was really surprised when I was walking with them and looking at what they collect. At one point, after about a few hours of collecting rubbish, they unpacked their bag, and I could see them scrambling in it and taking whether it was shoes or henna bottles or cassette tapes, and they were picking up hair. And I was thinking, what is this hair that they're picking and putting in this little place beside them? And I realized that actually the hair that they collect and they pry from the recycled material that they scavenge along the way is quite valuable. And they accumulate it over a couple of weeks, and then they sell this waste hair, the women brush, Indian women brush. They even recycle that, and they sell it to another person in the chain.
I understand that at the end of the chain, the finished hair is sent off overseas where it's used for wigs, but some hair has more value than others. You tell us that it's more valuable if it's from young people or if it's temple hair.
Yes, well, the Temple Hair is probably the most famous one. It's very lucrative. It's a multi-million dollar business. And it's because of life cycle and various rituals that women go to in South India in the temples. And over there, their hair is shaved and there's a legion of barbers who clean up the hair and then they auction the hair. The temple auctions the hair and to the highest bidder. And it's a multi-million dollar business. In the end, as you said, it reaches the high streets of London, or Africa is a big consumer of temple hair. But what was remarkable about what we found is that we're not talking about temple hair, we're talking about waist hair. The hair that women every day when they do their, let's say, everyday rituals of brushing, that they chuck away. And that hair is even valuable. And the person that we met, who actually is at the top of that recycling chair, told us that he exports 60 metric tons of waste hair every month. And I went to his factory, you know, he had a Mercedes. He was the self-styled king of hair. And it was like any other capitalist factory. And when I asked him, how many people do you employ? And he said, oh, hundreds of thousands. Of course, he didn't mean hundreds of thousands. These are the manual scavengers. And through the chain, they feed the waste hair into his factory, where people comb it and brush it and shampoo it and clean it. And then it's exported to different areas in the world.
Let's walk back to Modi and his toilets, because I remember in 2014 we were very enthusiastic on this program. It seemed to be a very bold initiative. Let's look at some of the issues, Robin, because one of the things, of course, is water. It must take vast amount of water to flush toilets. Where is the water coming from?
Well, of course, the toilets, if you go into the website of these Clean India Mission, you'll see that there's a ticker that tells you how many million toilets have been built. We're up, I think, to about 62 million new toilets. Now, these are mostly dry latrines, the kind that rural Australians would understand. At their most primitive, they're the dunny with the brown snake and the red back under the seat waiting for you in the middle of the night. And that's part of the reluctance in India, that these standalones have to be maintained and kept clean. That job does fall invariably to women. That's part of the difficulty. And of course, they have to be properly built. Even the old Australian dunny had to be a certain depth. The models that are available, the two-pit latrine, which is popular, requires one pit to be cleaned out every couple of years. Now, who's going to clean that pit? Well, in the old days, you would have whistled up the local untouchables in the village. But today, those people are much less reluctant, partly because of mobile phones, that they have rights and they're not keen on doing that kind of work. So who's going to clean them? And eventually you end up with two pits filled. And if the pits aren't dug deep enough, you've got a problem. So part of the problem with the toilet building campaign is the water one, and that no Indian city now is likely ever to be sewered in the way that is required and requires, of course, so much water.
Okay, now India has a huge air pollution problem. Mm-hmm. Delhi now makes China, it makes Beijing look almost fresh. Mm. A crisis like this, does this focus the Indian political mind wonderfully?
You'd like to think so. We have a hypothesis in the book that there is something called a binding crisis, where it's so awful for everybody, rich and poor alike, that action follows. It hasn't followed yet in the case of air pollution in Delhi. We'd like to think that if the awareness of the harm that open defecation and poor sanitation does to young children of the rich as well as the poor, if that becomes more commonly known, there'll be concerted action involving all classes to do something about it. The British, the London sewers resulted from the great stink of 1858, when the Thames was so awful, Parliament really couldn't meet, so passed legislation just so they could go home. And the sewerage that was built in London in the 1860s was partly a result of that terrible notion, but it improved the health of the poor as well as the rich.
Is there some hope in the number of NGOs and crisis groups that flourish in India, Robert?
We'd like to think so, but somebody like me has been putting my hope in those wonderful local groups for 35 years now. It's very hard to bring them together nationally, to bring something national out of this wonderful social energy that may get things done in a patchwork way around the country. So I think there is hope, but it lies in taking the best ideas of some of these groups and trying to grow them in other places.
And so India isn't monolithic. It's the most complicated and vast society. Are there parts of India, perhaps Kerala, who do things better?
Well, I think Kerala is doing things better, first and foremost, because it has a very high literacy rate and the education levels are the highest in India. So there
it used,
is more
used to be run by communists, I recall.
Indeed. So there's certainly more awareness about waste and sanitation, and in fact also regulation. So when I was in Kerala, what I found is the majority of the rubbish in Kerala is exported to the adjacent state of Tamil Nadu, where it is not as so-called developed as Kerala. And so you get in Tamil Nadu, you get all the they're offshoring their waste to the poorer state besides them.
Shifting waste around the place is also done in a huge scale in Australia. Many of those dumpsters are loaded into great big trucks and shunted up to Queensland. I mean, we're all good, not in our backyard attitude.
Exactly.
So we shove the rubbish around. Robin, are you optimistic? You love India.
I suppose I'm always glass half full and half empty at the same time. Good things are happening. There's never been a government and a prime minister who has put so much energy into the whole notion of public health and public sanitation. Now, whether that energy is being well spent, the problem is that the campaign so far has been terribly target-driven and top-down. And where the successes come from, they bubble up from the bottom, seeking aid from the top, seeking money, seeking expertise. But the rewards aren't forthcoming to the people actually doing some of the most exciting work at the patchwork level around the country.
Robin Jeffrey and Asa Dornan there, and the book is A Waste of a Nation, Garbage and Growth in India.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.